I wanted last night to give you the first movement. Oh, it's later than I thought. To give you the first movement of Beethoven's third, so that you should see the good side of Beethoven. I mean, there's a great deal to him. He's one of the greats in his own on his own terms. And it's no use pretending that he's a pygmy. But he illustrates a major point about music, and I was saying to you the other night that that point is that music is objective. I'm sure that's not what's said in the music faculties today. In other words, certain musical effects certain musical forms, ways of writing, have certain effects upon the soul. The soul is, in its structure, objective. Life is objective. Music is objective. The subjects skid around all over the objective geography, but if you want to go to Rome, you don't sort of head westwards across the Pacific. If you want to arrive in Australia, you don't head eastwards across the Atlantic. The ship is free to go where it likes, but where it's going to go, if it goes east, it's going to arrive in such a place. If it's going to go west, it's going to arrive in such a certain place. Liberalism says things differently. Liberalism thinks that everything is up for grabs. Liberalism wants to make everything up for grabs. In music too. Liberalism wants to remake human nature. It believes that, and it teaches that we are what we make of ourselves entirely. There's no structure that we have to conform to which we have to submit or that we cannot step outside of. The structures are ours to change as we like. And the same idea applies to music. Music is exactly what we like. There's nothing objective about it. One composer could use this trick and it would have exactly the opposite effect from the same another composer using the same trick, etc. I don't believe it. So there's a great deal of room for choice. We're creatures of free will, but at the same time, there is an objective structure of things, and this is very much illustrated with Beethoven. I'd be very interested to see. I suspect that the corresponding figure around 1600 was Monteverdi. I suspect that Monteverdi is a pivotal figure. He's nothing like Beethoven, so far as I know, but I ask myself if he didn't occupy some such role. I'd love to know if one could, if there's a possibility of conducting the same kind of analysis as I'm going to conduct tonight on Monteverdi for 200 years early. Beethoven is, of course, around 1800. The thing to remember about Beethoven in particular, that he straddles the 18th and the 19th centuries. He's born and rooted in the 18th century, and he is up front and launches like the music of the 19th century. And he was well rooted in the 18th century. He really learned his craft. He learned from the great masters. And then what he learned, he took in a new direction. All right, now, the structure of the soul. You've done that at the seminary. Aristotle teaches, you've seen this many times. The church has taken it over. The three layers of the soul, the intellective layer, which is the highest that is unique to men, the sensitive layer, which we share with animals who have senses, and the vegetative layer, which we share with the animals and with plants. The vegetative layer has three faculties. This is all Aristotle's analysis. The generative, which is the most noble, because it operates outside. The augmentative, which is the power to grow, and the digestive, which is the power to digest. Those are three faculties or powers that all plants have, that all animals have, that all human beings have. That doesn't interest us tonight. What interests us tonight is the intellective and the sensitive layers of the soul, and you know, of course, that again Aristotle divides them into the apprehendors, that's a funny language, the apprehendors and the appetitors. In more ordinary English, those are faculties of knowing and faculties of desiring. That is an extremely deep, it's not an arbitrary thing that Aristotle invented, it's a law of reality which he discovered, that upon every form follows an inclination. And the information upon every information follows a corresponding inclination or desire. So that knowing specifies desiring, or knowing is the form, inform, knowing informs, literally informs desiring. At the sensitive layer, the knowing faculties, again, they don't interest us tonight. There are 5 outer senses and 4 inner senses. Many of you already know that from having studied psychology. The 5 outer senses, seeing, hearing, touching, tasting, and the last one I can't remember for the moment, was it seeing, hearing, touching, tasting, and smelling, that's it, of course. The 4 inner faculties, memory, the estimative, instinct, and so on. Then, the intellective knower is, of course, the mind. Actually, Aristotle divides that, as you know, into 2 faculties, the age and intellect, but that doesn't concern us tonight. It's actually 2 faculties, but we'll just leave it at the mind for tonight. What does interest us, especially, is the desiring faculties. We're into question 81 and 82 of the Prima Powers, and, as you know, the intellective appetite is the precise definition of the faculty of will. And that is only 1 faculty. The rational will. And reason is a name that you can give to both of those together. Mind and will taken together. Because that is, if man is a rational animal, it's that whole rational layer of rationality which specifies man, in which case mind and will together you can call reason, or more narrowly you can call mind alone reason. But in any case, the will is a rational faculty in that broad sense. And then the sense desirer is, as you may remember, we've only got in English 2 Latin names for it. We take over the irascible and the concupiscible. They're named from the Latin. The irascible is named from anger, which is the outstanding passion of the of one of the 2 sense appetites. And concupiscible is named from desire, which is the outstanding passion of the other of the 2 sense appetites. Aristotle divides them into 2 because the concupiscible essentially goes for or goes away from the good, simply, the sense good, whereas the irascible goes towards or away from the difficult good. So there are 5 passions in the irascible, analyzes Aristotle, and 6 passions in the concupiscible. This does concern us. The number of passions does not concern us. Though it would be very interesting sometime to do an analysis of Beethoven, of a Beethoven piece, on, or in any other composer who's full of passions, on the actual play of the passions in one of the, in some piece of music. It would be very interesting. And relate that to the interplay of the passions, which St. Thomas analyzes following Aristotle around question 28 to 42 in the Prima Secundae. In any case, if this is the structure of the soul and the structure of the natural soul, and all the wisdom of Mother Church tells us that it is, by the way, very interesting to see how Rousseau threw this over. Rousseau doesn't buy this. What does he buy? Interesting question. Well worth looking at. Of course, in fact, this is the truth. But Rousseau had a different idea. In any case, then even Rousseau as human beings still operate on this basis. This is still the correct analysis of how the human soul works and how people work. Now, music is eminently an activity of the soul. Actually, animals and plants, it's interesting, do respond to music. That's been proved in the American laboratories recently. I'm sure all of you have heard the story of the, I think it was in Colorado, they've done it in many places and many times. They set up four boxes, same sand, same water, same earth, same light, same climatic conditions, same warmth, and the same plant in each of four boxes. And then into one of the boxes they constantly pipe Gregorian, into another box they constantly pipe classical music, another box they pipe simple silence, and another box they pipe rock. Within a short space of time, the poor plant in the rock box is keeled right over. It's kaput. On the other hand, the one that thrives best is the plant in the Gregorian box. The same with animals. It's very well known that if you want the cows to give more milk, you pipe Muzak into the barn as you're milking them, and so on. Animals do respond to music. Ovid said that Orpheus could stop the running waters with his music. Quid mare non novit, quae nescit arion atelius, carmine currentes illi tenebat aquas. Carmine, with his song, currentes, the running aquas waters, tenebat he held. Carmine currentes illi tenebat aquas. He checked the waters with his song. So in other words, Orpheus could play music and the very waters in the brooks would stop to listen. That was the mythological power of music, but there's a lot more wisdom in saying that that music can stop water than pretending that music is just like sneezing, or that music is just like, I don't know, any of the other vegetative accusatives or whatever. It's not. Music is, there was always used to be a little thing on the wall here. There it is, yes. Somebody read it. There we are. For heights and depths no words can reach, music is the soul's own speech. Some of you have been getting a little to know opera, and some of you, a couple of years back, you saw the difference between Othello and Otello. And you could see what the dramatist can do, and there's much more argument in what the dramatist can do. The dramatist can lay out a lot more ideas, but what's going, the feelings, the reactions, and not just the lower kinds of feelings, but all what the soul is experiencing, music has got a power to express which words can't get near. Music is a very human activity. If music is a very human activity, then music lands on here somewhere. Music comes from this soul, all right? Well, I think one thing is, a classical analysis of music is that it has three elements. It has three main elements: melody, harmony, and rhythm. I hope all of you know what those are. Melody is quite simply a tune. Harmony is the accompaniment of a tune. As Dr. de Villard was explaining the other day, polyphony is basically two tunes running at the same time, whereas harmony is one tune with an accompaniment fitting that tune. Classical music is mostly, I forget the technical term for it, homophony, that's it. Homophony, voice, funny, homo, one voice synchronized. Polyphony, many voices. Homophony, all on one voice, or like on one voice. Alright, so, harmony is like the accompaniment of a tune. Rhythm is obviously, I'm sure you know what rhythm is. Rhythm is the, I don't know what the definition is, everyone knows what it is. The definition of rhythm? Sorry? Ordered movement is, sounds a bit vague. In music, We all know what it is. Africans are gifted with a sense of rhythm. I was saying to you, Beethoven has a powerful sense of rhythm. It's the I hope you already know what it is without having to define any further. I'd like a decent definition. I don't think ordered movement is precise enough. However, now these three, it's easy to say, fit as follows. I mean, you can argue that melody is the rational element of music. Melody is the highest element of music. For instance, Gregorian chant is pure melody. And it goes straight to the mind. It goes straight to the higher part of the soul, without even, so to speak, passing. It just passes through the lower part of the soul. The Gregorian chant skids above the lower part of the soul. The lower part of the soul is largely tranquilized by Gregorian chant, so to speak. That's one example of melody going to the higher part of the soul. There is rhythm in Gregorian chant, of course there is, but it's a rhythm which is completely subservient to the melody. It's a rhythm which is built into the melody. Whereas in Beethoven's orchestra, he's got drums which are incapable of a tune, but I definitely mark the beat for the violins which carry the tune, so that the rhythm is kind of, in a certain way, at least instrumentally, exterior to the melody. In Gregorian chant, you've got no drums, you've got no percussion. All you've got is the vocal line, and the rhythm is completely intrinsic to the vocal line. If there is rhythm, and there are harmonic effects in, there are harmonic intervals in Gregorian chant, but of course there's no polyphony in Gregorian chant, and therefore you don't get any homophony. You don't get, it's uniphony or monophony. Monophony, the single alone voice. Let's assume that, you can argue, for instance, art, that the equivalent in art is is lines. What actually carries the lines of a statue or the lines of a drawing? That's what carries the message and the meaning. The color accompanies the lines. You can't make a picture purely of color unless, like the abstracts, you disintegrate line. But if you disintegrate line, the picture disintegrates, the meaning disintegrates. Unless the colors, like in Cézanne, clearly suggest line, or strongly suggest line in Cézanne. But, in other words, line carries the meaning, carries the meaning for the mind. Color appeals to the senses. You talk, for instance, in a symphony, you talk about orchestral color, that you splash the color of the oboes, or the color of the bassoon, or the color of the dark cellos, or whatever it is. If you talk about orchestral color, orchestration is a side element, like color. Some modern composers, the melody has largely gone, and it's very much just the orchestration which is left. The color, there's color without line. In any case, so just as you might have line in art, you would have line carrying the message for the mind, and then color appealing to the senses, so in music, it's very easy to argue that melody carries the meaning, melody in the broadest sense, not just in the modern tuneful sense, but including the line of a Gregorian chant, for instance. You'd hardly speak of tunes in Gregorian chant, but there's certainly a musical line, and that musical line, there you are again. You're borrowing from art the word line to talk about a musical line which is melody. Line corresponds to melody. Line in art corresponds to melody in music. They're both that part of music and art which carry the meaning for the mind. Or color is an accompaniment, and you could say the harmony and the rhythm are essentially accompaniment. And you can approximately divide the two. If you want to psych up soldiers to go to war, well, of course, now you undoubtedly play rap so that they can sit down at their computers and punch the buttons to send the Tomahawk missiles over. But in the old days, if they had to actually get up and themselves do the fighting, and they needed some courage to do it, you did it with kettle drums. Brum, brum, brum. And then everybody, like horses, they flared up in order to go to battle. Irascible rhythm. Broadly speaking. And that suggests harmony for the concupiscible. Broadly speaking. Certainly rhythm can serve for to arouse desire. Certainly an ugly harmony can express the irascible passions. But broadly speaking, either way, those two elements, while they are carried in purely melodic music, Gregorian chant, they are much more prominent in other kinds of music which are not Gregorian, and they, in other words, they indicate an appeal which is more to the senses, along with the melody which is appealing to the reason. The rhythm and harmony appeal rather more to the senses. In polyphony, there's rather in the great polyphony of the Palestrina song, there is more, it's still very sublime. Palestrina is very sublime. But there is more appeal to the senses than there is in Gregorian. Whereas Gregorian goes straight through the ear to the soul, part of polyphony stops in the ear because it pleases the ear. There's very little appeal to the ear as ear in Gregorian. It just goes, the ear is purely a carrier. But in polyphony, you're listening to the beautiful music is drawing attention to itself. The Gregorian is not drawing attention. The Gregorian, is just a straight window on God in a manner of speaking. The polyphony is certainly a window on God, but it's more drawing attention to itself. Because there's rather more harmony. Even if it isn't homophonic, it's still, the polyphonic is still an effect of the voices at the same time. It's like harmony. Therefore there's a harmonic element which there isn't in Gregorian chant. So, polyphony is more appealing to the senses than Gregorian. Then an interesting corroboration of this is that as music descends from a higher level to a lower level, so music tends to split. It splits into at its worst slush and rap. The rap, just without music, without melody at all, just expressing the anger, the rhythm expressing the anger of these revolting creatures, and the slush, Frank Sinatra and all of that, harmony run riot. Sinatra is, at his best, I do believe, I'm told, has some musical gifts, I'm willing to believe it, but he represents, generally speaking, an awful degeneracy of music. Not everybody would agree with that, but it's this sentimentalization. Sentimentality. The concupiscible uncontrolled by reason. Sentimentality. And the irascible uncontrolled by reason, violence. Violence and sentimentality. And music splitting into violence and sentimentality is a strong indication. It's common sense. It's sheer common sense. It's descent, it's common sense that it's lower level music, but it's a simple corroboration of Aristotle's common sense division of the lower appetite into those two faculties, anger, war, and love, desire. So you get music which is exaggeratedly lovey-lovey, and the music which is exaggeratedly angry-angry. You could say that such a division is very clear in Beethoven. But we'll come to that. Now, let's assume that that music broadly divides as such that melody carries the meaning for the mind, for the mind and the world, the reason, for the higher soul, whereas rhythm and the harmony are the elements to which you will rather more appeal and give more importance if you want to go to the lower soul. Not the lowest, but the lower soul. Now, What is revolution? Revolution is taking what is lower and putting it higher. That's, if a wheel does a revolution, revolution means taking the lower elements and putting them higher, and taking the higher elements and putting them lower. If a wheel does a revolution, that's what you're going to get. Therefore, what you would expect of a revolution in music, a revolution in music will mean that rhythm and harmony go on top and melody comes down below. And if you want to express revolution in music, you will express it by destroying melody and by unleashing rhythm and or harmony. And I was saying, modern trash music is very often uncontrolled rhythm and or uncontrolled harmony, with little melodic interest. Now, so the revolution music will show us rhythm and harmony gaining importance, and melody will show us melody being dethroned and rhythm and harmony being enthroned. Let us take an interesting example, a very clear example. Beethoven gives us some very clear illustrations of this point, especially the famous works of Beethoven. Beethoven wrote a lot of music, but there are certain works which he's famous, like the Third Symphony, the Fifth Symphony, the Ninth Symphony, the Partial Symphony, the Seventh Symphony, his symphonies especially, also certain piano sonatas, the Moonlight, the Pathetique Sonata, the Moonlight Sonata, the Appassionata Sonata. Certain pieces are famous. Those famous pieces, interestingly enough, are those in which this process can most be seen. In other words, what, in a sense, what a lot of people get out of Beethoven is when he's expressing this, precisely this revolution. Let's have a look, firstly, at the second subject of the Fifth Symphony. This is not one you heard the last time. Your last time you heard the Third, this is the Fifth. Listen to the rhythm underneath. It's the famous symphony, ta-ta-ta-tum, and this second subject, that motif is underneath. Listen to it and see what you notice. Notice what's, the melody is above. Ta-ta-ta-tum, tum, ta, da-da-da-da-da, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Listen to the rhythm underneath. And listen to what the rhythm does and listen to what the melody does. Okay, now, here's the melody. Where are we? And then it goes on. Let's have a look at the melody first. This. That's five notes there. One, two, three, four, five. The melody still has five notes to it, repeated. Again, up here. Now then, I repeat. How many notes are there? Four. One, two, sorry. One, two, three, four. It's come down from five to four. Repeat. Four. Repeat. Now again. Now listen to this. Again. It's been reduced to three. One, two, three. One, two, three. One, two, three. Therefore, the melody is getting shortened off. It's also getting repeated. You see, the dynamism of the music is shortening the melody down, whereas on the other hand, in the bass, you have the rhythm. Two. Two, three, four. Two, three, four. Two, three, four. As the melody is getting sawn off, the rhythm is getting more intense, is getting more and more repeated. At first, that motif in underneath was only once every four bars, and then it's once every two bars. Again, notice that that rhythm had a tiny bit of melody to it. But then, the little rhythm that there was, the little melody that there was, so to speak, is gone. Listen again. In other words, the picture is the rhythm eating up the melody. The melody getting sawn off, cut down, whereas the dynamism underneath is shaking it to pieces, so to speak. It's melodious. Example I owe to Leonard Bernstein. I remember a lecture of music and she pointed that out. And there are many, many, that's like a fingerprint of Beethoven's music, the intensification, the intensity, the drive, this drive which takes hold of the melody and is going, and rhythm is rising up from beneath. This is the revolution. Second example. From the Appassionata Sonata, which is a very great piece. Lenin loved it. And that tells you something about the Appassionata Sonata. Lenin loved it. It's a very, very well-known piece, and it's a very modern piece. There is a lovely melody in the exposition. The second subject of the exposition is another noble Beethoven melody, as he could write. You had a few examples in the Eroica last night. The second subject is the sonata that starts like this. Something like that. Notice again, that's actually just an arpeggio. There's not much melody there. There's a little melody at the end, but otherwise it's just the arpeggio. Now, but here is the second subject, which is a very grand and lovely melody. That's a noble melody, and it's a real melody. Now listen to what happens. Notice, however, even in the exposition, what happens to it. It begins dolce, tranquillo, sweetly, quietly, con molto espressione, with lots of expression. The melody just stops, ends in a kind of question mark. It's very, very pianistic, and it comes all the way up to the top and all the way down. Now listen to what happens to that melody in the development. It's a very powerful, a very grand and powerful piece, which is why Lenin loved it. But be prepared to play it again if you can get it back to the beginning. But notice again what happens to that melody. The melody is like the demons of the rhythm get hold of it. Where is this? I'm going to make Yes, here it is. Listen again to exactly what happens. It starts out like in the exposition. Where is it? There it is. Then a sudden key swirl. Off again. See what's happened? The melody is, the keys are yanking it out of joint, so to speak, and then finally all that's left of it is so yanked out of joint, all that's left are the last two notes. Dun da da dun da da dun da da da. That's all that's left. And then it just a cascade, it breaks out into a cascade. It's sheer common sense. I mean, you don't have to be a genius to realize that the way that Beethoven is getting his effects is to saw off, to chop off the melodies, to strangle the melody and let loose the rhythm. The piano then, as you heard, it cascades upwards, and then it cascades all the way downwards. It's very pianistic, until when it gets to the bottom, then rhythm takes over. Ta-ta-ta-tum. It's the same motif as the Fifth Symphony. It was written about the same time as the Fifth Symphony. Ta-ta-ta-tum, 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 ta-ta-ta-tum. Repeated, that motif, the rhythm repeated. And then it goes into the recapitulation. Play it again. Lovely. Melodious. just the last two notes. It breaks up. Breaks down. That's the recapitulation. That's the first subject. Notice now the agitation underneath, which there wasn't at the end. All right. The agitation that underneath the rumbling, like the rumbling which carries it from the development breaking all the way down again, and then that hammering rhythm, that rumbling underneath, stays underneath the first subject. In the exposition, the first subject was without any rumbling. I tried to play it a few moments ago. There's no rumbling, there's just the... But at the recapitulation, you've just been hearing it, it is that rumbling is underneath. Sorry. Where is it? That's not it. Where is it? I'm sorry, I've lost it for a moment. Hold on. Here it is. That's the 19th century. There's that rumbling underneath. The French monarchy is restored, but it's not on the same basis as it was before. It's rumbling. A third example from the... So you can see here the rhythm clearly taking over from the melody. I mean, the rhythm... the melody comes back. Last night in the Eroica, we'll play this, you saw that after the rhythm had taken over and again smashed the melody to pieces, virtually smashed the melody to pieces, then after the storm of rhythm, the melody, it quietened down again, in came a lovely new melody. So the tension between rhythm and melody is very typical of Beethoven. It's very often there. Now, but the greater importance, but also harmony. If we're correct here, we might also see harmony taking over from melody. Now, I suggested that to you last night when I said the second subject of the first movement of the Eroica is of little interest melodically. You heard it last night. We're not going to play it on the tape recorder tonight, but this was the tune melodically. So on. Of little interest. On the other hand, melodic, like harmonically. I'm sorry. It's a lot more interesting. The same with the slow movement of the Appassionata Sonata. It's a theme and variations. Listen to the theme, the melodic line. The line is of very little interest. Here it is. Listen to this. This is the slow movement of a great sonata. Can you believe it? Absolutely nothing. But now listen to the accompaniment. It's a lot more interesting, especially that, obviously, that I don't know what that is, but that. Thank you. so on. The melody is nothing. Nothing. The harmony is you can't exactly say taking over from the melody, but the harmony is certainly of much more importance than it than it's almost, at that particular point. It's of equal importance with the melody. There's a variation which becomes very melodic and very lovely again, but the harmony is becoming a lot more important. I think Ravel. Some pieces of Ravel are harmony almost without melody. The whole interest is in the harmony rather than the melody. That's typical of the line disappearing, mind disappearing, the death of reason, modern civilization. People don't know how to think, they don't want to think, they've got nothing to think about. Stravinsky can't write a melody to save his life. And he's not the only one. There's no melody there. There's no content there. They've got nothing to say. And so these are musicians with nothing to say. They may be brilliant at all kinds of tricks, but there's no tune. It's as simple and as common sense as that. They have no tunes. I mean, at least Frank Sinatra has tunes. Give him that. And Bing Crosby. You know. I mean, it's slush, but at least there's a tune still there. It's got that much common sense and health in it. All right, let's take a third example. Is from the Eroica Symphony. This is in the development, and you heard it last night. It's the second section of the development. We'll hear it from the beginning. We'll hear TC, the third of the transition themes to begin with, and then it comes back to the first subject. And then the first subject gets broken up into, the technical term is fugato. There's a kind of fugal writing. Notice how the first subject, there is a tune there. But, as it gets more and more broken up, on the other hand, the rhythmic interest, the transition theme is again a tune. Sorry. Soon after that, it gets rather more rhythmic and rather less melodic progressively, more rhythmic, progressively less melodic, until you get this tremendous rhythmic effect here, this kind of thing. There's no melodic interest. The interest is rhythmic. You've got again this two against three. It's not all just two against three, but it's varied, and that's where the interest is. One, two, three. Two, three. There you've got two against three. And then they're just a succession of chords. You go into a different chord. And then the same rhythmic effect until you hit this conclusion of... And then this horrible discord. One moment, I could hear anything and it would sound right, but this is about it. Again, purely melodic, two against three, purely rhythmic. There's no harmony now, it's pure rhythm. But, with Beethoven, the melody does come back. Here it comes back.